Good morning. I'm Bruce McGregor. She is
Chris McGregor.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Mike Aquilina, the editor of more than a dozen books on Catholic history, doctrine, and devotion, vice president of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology based in Steubenville, Ohio. And we are delighted to have him with us this morning. Mike, good morning and welcome back.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, Chris. I'm delighted to be here. It's great to be back with you and with your listeners.
Our listeners are excited because when they heard you were coming, we've already gotten emails, and they've loved it when you've been here to talk to us about the Church Fathers. So it just seemed natural for us to take this fantastic resource that you have in the Mass of the Early Christians and kind of break that open over the next few weeks.
Well, this is one of my favorite subjects, so I'm really glad to have the conversation.
The thing about the Mass for the Early Christians, I think you asked the question right off the bat, Chapter 1, how did the first Christians experience the Mass?
Yes, and that might take some people aback because we're used to talking about the early Christians in terms of persecution and a lot of things that really were incidental to their lives, and they weren't constant. But the one thing that was constant was the Mass. They went to Mass, and we know that from the time of the Acts of the Apostles onward, we can think of them as Bible Christians, you know, the way some people like to. And indeed, they were eager to hear the Word of God. But we have to remember, they didn't have books. They didn't have printing presses. There was no canon of the Bible. So where did they hear the Scriptures? Where were the Scriptures kept? They were kept in the Mass. They were proclaimed in the Mass. The Mass was the focus of their lives. And that's what it meant to be a Christian, was to go to Mass.
As you point out in the book, that wherever the church spread, the church established liturgy.
That's right. And in the Acts of the Apostles, there's a great line, Acts 2:42. It says, Luke tells us that the first Christians, one and all, devoted themselves to the teaching of the apostles and to the communion. The word is koinonia in Greek. To the breaking of the bread and the prayers. Well, let's think about those things. The teaching of the apostles, the communion, the breaking of the bread, and the prayers. What do those four things describe? They describe the act that defined the early Christians, and it's the act that defines us today as Christians. It's the Mass. We identify ourselves with the Mass. And sure enough, wherever the apostles went, one of the first things they did was they established the Mass. As soon as they had Christians, and they had Christians who were mature enough, they would ordain priests, local priests, who could continue the celebration of the Eucharist, who could continue the Christian liturgy, in that place. In all those apocryphal Acts of the Apostles that we have from the early church, it shows this again and again. In the Acts of John, in the Acts of Thomas, in the Acts of Jude Thaddeus, what we find is that when these men went to India or Edessa or Ephesus or any of the places they went, the first thing they would do is they'd teach people, get them up to speed, and they'd ordain priests and teach them how to say the Mass. So there's that great line in the prophet Malachi, that from the rising of the sun to its setting, a perfect offering may be made, as we say in the third Eucharistic prayer when we quote it at Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that line was used over and over again by the early fathers to describe the Mass, because now, from the rising of the sun to its setting, from east to west, from every direction and all the times of day, the Mass was being celebrated all throughout the world.
And that's so beautiful when you put it in that context.
Oh yes, yes. What's great, Chris, is that down through those ages, the Mass is the most thoroughly documented thing in the early church, and that's what I wanted to preserve in this book, The Mass of the Early Christians. I wanted to show the paper trail of the Mass going from every generation, from the New Testament until the time of the Council of Nicaea. So we have a 300-year span. And we're showing that the Mass was celebrated, and we're showing how the Mass was celebrated in various times and various places through those generations. So when you hear people say crazy things, you know, anti-Catholics will sometimes say that that the Mass is a 4th-century invention. Well,
right.
That's absurd, because
yeah.
We can show the Mass in every single generation from the time of the apostles until our own day today.
Well, and the thing too, Mike, is that, I mean, Christianity really grew quickly in the Roman Empire. By the 4th century that you were referencing, what, almost half of the population were Christian, were they not?
That's right, that's right. And as a matter of fact, by the time Christianity was legalized, Constantine wasn't so much giving them a break as just recognizing the reality, mm-hmm. realized that you could not continue fighting this movement. You had to either go with the flow or just be one of history's losers. And he went with the flow. I mean, I think there were miraculous interventions in history too, but Constantine was a smart guy, and he could read the signs of the times.
And just as with any work by Mike Aquilino, you're going to find in the Mass of the Early Christians documentation, like you said, the paper trail. Mm-hmm. You cite so many references that it's hard to dispute anything.
Well, I try to put all the paper in there so that people can see it with their own eyes and make their own judgments. But I tried also to give a lot of picturesque details so that people can get into it. Even though these are texts that are 2,000 years old, I try to give them an angle of entry into every text, and I try to point out the things that are practical and useful for living today. Because sometimes when we read things 2,000 years old, they seem obscure to us.
Mm-hmm. And really, not as so much of an aside, but it's fascinating to see how you make a point of showing there's a definite connection between the Mass and holy orders, that they really walk hand in hand, all three of the different levels of holy orders.
Well, as I said, the apostles, wherever they went, they were looking to ordain priests and ordain bishops. We see that in St. Paul's letters, that he was very concerned about naming elders wherever he went. Well, the elders were the presbyteroi, the presbyters, the priests.
Mm-hmm.
And he was careful to name bishops, overseers in all those places. So in the early church, the bishop was the regular celebrant of the Mass in a given place. Now, mm-hmm. as the church grew, you needed to have more people available to say Mass because you had more people ready to go to Mass. So you had to ordain more or delegate. The bishops had to delegate the saying of Mass to their priests.
And also the service of deacons.
Oh, that's evident from the earliest time, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the deacons, of course, played an active role in every liturgy. They were the servants at the Mass. They were often the ones who were making things run smoothly as kind of masters of ceremonies. They guarded the doors during times of persecution, very practical things like that the mm-hmm. deacons did. They prepared the altar. They prepared the gifts for the offertory, and often they took the gifts up at the offertory. So yes, the deacon played an active role in the liturgical celebration. You had the bishop, you had the priest, and you had the deacon, and everyone had a role in the Mass.
Right, and deacons, of course, too, one of the very important things they did in their day was taking Eucharist to the sick and homebound as well.
Right, and that we find that as early as Justin Martyr in the middle of the 100s A.D., you know, when he's describing a Mass as it was celebrated in Rome. And that's the quotation. That quotation is actually used in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. So it's wonderful to see that a quotation from a writer, a Christian writer, in 155 A.D., we can still use that in our catechism to describe the Mass we attend today.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The Mass is that much alike that we can still use that as a catechetical text. But as you say, Bruce, at the end of Mass, it's not as if the presence of Christ vanishes from the Eucharistic species, the bread and wine, at the end of Mass. No, Christ is still present there. And Justin makes that very clear because he describes the deacons taking the Eucharist out to the sick and the homebound, which is something, of course, that still happens today in every parish in the United States.
Yep, absolutely.
Something when you see the connection between our generation and theirs, it's so clear.
And what Jesus did when he, as a Jew, and his apostles as Jews, connected this to the altar of Israel.
Oh, sure. I tried to point out all of the ritual continuity between those first Christians and their Jewish roots, the various rites that they observed as Jews, and there were so many of them. And we can find the influence of those rites in the earliest liturgies of the Church. There was, for example, a bread and wine liturgy called a sacrifice that involved a meal of bread and wine, and it was called the Todah.
Mm.
And many scholars, both Protestant and Catholic, recognize this bread and wine sacrifice as a forebear of the Eucharist, as foreshadowing the Eucharist.
Mm-hmm.
During the time of King David and afterwards, the Todah was the most important sacrifice in the temple cult. in Jerusalem.
Right.
So the Todah became something that really defined the Jewish religion at the time of Christ. And Todah means thanksgiving.
Mm.
And often, the Greek-speaking Jews would translate that word Todah as Eucharistia.
Mm.
And you can
okay.
see
sure.
that the first Greek-speaking Christians just seized on that word, Eucharistia, thanksgiving, to describe their main sacrifice, their main meal, which was the Eucharist. So we can see that the Todah kind of segues very nicely into the sacrifice of the Eucharist.
Right, and actually, as you point out too, Mike, that the Talmud recording rabbinic teaching that with the coming of the Messiah, all the sacrifices would cease except for that Todah sacrifice.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
So that we can see that even in the Jews of the time of Christ, that they were already saying that when the Messiah came, all sacrifice would cease except that bread and wine sacrifice of thanksgiving, of Eucharistia, of Todah, and this is what we celebrate today. Even in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they describe a messianic meal of bread and wine that's celebrated by the Messiah himself. And this is, again, we can see that there was this expectation, this longing, this sense in the people of God, God's holy people, his chosen people, were expecting salvation to erupt in this way. You know, they couldn't see it very clearly, but they could see that something was about to happen. This is the way God works things out for us.
Amazing.
It's a good thing.
Yes, it is.
God is very good.
Many other ritual meals that were part of the Jewish culture at that time that I describe in the book. There are many meal blessings that we have, and in some cases we can even fairly accurately trace the development of the meal blessings from the time from their Jewish usage to their earliest Christian usage too. And we can see how they were transformed. A number of scholars have done this in books other than mine, but I refer to those in my book.
Well, once again, for our listening audience, the Mass of the Early Christians is the book that we're speaking about by Mike Aquilina. We're so blessed to be able to take out just snippets, but everything that we're talking about, there's so much more. We will never be able to, unless we spent hours and hours, which I probably could with Mike, but there is so much to discover. This is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for you folks to get out there and to learn and to understand why.
It's good to know. You know, there's such an obsession with genealogy today, and people want to know about their roots. Well, when we read the fathers of the church and when we read these early Christians, we're reading our roots. We're getting back to it, and we're seeing that connection. I think so often when people do genealogies, that's what they want to see. They want to see the connection with their ancient forebears. They want to see where they came from. Well, this is where we came from, and these are our ancestors. And their life was in so many ways like ours. So anyway, it's exciting material.
Oh, right. It is.
We are visiting with Mike Aquilina, the book, The Mass of the Early Christians. We are going to take a very quick break, and we'll be right back here. Spirit Mornings, don't go away, and that's an order. Good morning, Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
That would be you. We're the McGregors together. Joined today, great to have him on board, Mike Aquilina. We are talking about the Mass of the Early Christians.
You talked in the book, Mike, about how the liturgy makes all things new. All things are made new, and the reflections of the heavenly liturgy that the fathers talk about.
Yes, that is one of the great secrets of the Mass. Really, it's a when we go to Mass, we go to heaven. It's not like we're learning about heaven or anything like that, although that's happening too. But we are going to heaven. We are in the presence of Jesus Christ, the real presence of Jesus Christ. He's there, body, blood, soul, and divinity, in all of his glory.
Isn't that great?
We can't... It is great. It's an awesome thing, and he has given us this. You know, he said, do this in remembrance of me. And when he used that word, that the Greek word for remembrance, anamnesis, and its Hebrew forebear too, both meant a real presence, not just a kind of psychological act of recollection.
Mm-hmm.
What he was talking about was a remembering. You know, he was pulling his members together, and he's there in our presence, and that's an exciting thing. You find that palpable in the Mass of the early Christians. They weren't sitting around on their hands waiting for Jesus to return. they were going to Mass because they knew that that's where he was going to return. That's the place and the time of the second coming. And Jesus comes to them there. Two very, very renowned non-Catholic scholars, Yaroslav Pelikan, who at the time was writing as a Lutheran, and Gregory Dix, who was writing as an Anglican, both said that this is the constant sense of the early church. You find it in all the fathers consistently, that when they went to Mass, there was this real presence of Christ, and it was the parousia, the second coming of Christ, that he was there. Now, when Jesus comes at the end of time, he's not going to have any more glory than when he comes to us in the Mass. He's there in all of his glory. The difference will be, at the end of time, that we'll be able to see it. But, you know, blessed are those who now, you know, can't see it, but still believe.
I love that you quoted St. Ignatius about the Eucharist when he said that it is the medicine of immortality.
Yes, yes, the medicine of immortality, because we already taste heaven when we go to Mass. We find this developed later on through the later fathers, where they really get into our participation in the resurrected flesh of Jesus Christ, and so that our own flesh becomes enabled to be resurrected by our participation, our communion in the body and blood, soul and divinity of Jesus Christ. Ignatius is a great character because he's one of the earliest fathers we have the writings of.
Mm-hmm.
He was writing around 107 AD, and he was on his way to martyrdom, and while he was on his way, he was writing letters to all the churches he visited.
Wow.
And he often talked about the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. This is a recurring theme in his writings. And the great thing about Ignatius is he's not just referring to it as an event, something he's planning to do.
Mm-hmm.
In Ignatius, we already have a theology of the Eucharist. He is identifying himself with the Eucharist. He's talking about it. He's talking about it as the mark of Christianity. One of my friends was a Protestant minister, and he was converted when he read in Ignatius that one of the marks of a heretic is that they deny that the Eucharist is the flesh and blood of Jesus Christ.
Ooh. Okay.
And he was converted by reading that.
Well, good for him.
Yes, yes.
Blessed is he who just reads and believes.
Right, and you can trust someone like Ignatius. Why can you trust Ignatius? Because he was willing to give it all. He was willing to die. He was eager to die. He was excited about dying for the faith. He was willing to give it all for what he believed. It cost him everything, and he was willing to pay that price. You know, some people take issue with the fact that we call the Eucharist the sacrifice or a sacrifice. They say that there was only one sacrifice. You know, they'll quote Hebrews and say that the one sacrifice is the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, and that's true. But the Eucharist is our participation in that sacrifice. You know, Jesus wanted that to be for every generation and for every place on earth, and not just for his people in his time. He wanted it to be for you and me, too. And this is the way that we participate in that event. And Ignatius could feel that. He could feel himself participating in that event. And so when he wrote about it, and he would talk about imitating Christ to the death, he would identify himself with the Eucharist. Do you mind if I read just a couple of quotes from him?
Oh, please do.
He wrote to the Romans. That's where he was going to be executed. He was going to be killed in the circus. And he wrote to the Romans, "Grant me nothing more than that I be poured out to God while an altar is still ready."
Mm.
So he sees himself as a libation, as wine being poured out. And later in the same letter, he wrote, "Let me be food for the wild beasts, through whom I can reach God. I am God's wheat, ground fine by the lion's teeth to be made purest bread for Christ."
Mm.
Purest bread for Christ, purest wine. Ignatius is bread and he is wine. His martyrdom is a sacrifice. It's a mass. And we find that in so many of the fathers. Ignatius's good friend, St. Polycarp of Smyrna, he also died a martyr's death. And when he was there, he was burned at the stake. And when he was there, and this was, again, just a few years after Ignatius, but when he was there at the stake, he recited this long prayer, and it was a Eucharistic prayer. People could recognize it down through the the era of the early church as a Eucharistic prayer. It had all the elements of thanksgiving and then doxology, just like we have today. And there's this beautiful touch. His secretary wrote an account of it that was around from the year after his death until our own day. Mm-hmm. And he describes Polycarp. He said he gave off not the smell of burning flesh, but the aroma of baking bread. Mm. So when Polycarp was giving himself in martyrdom, he was the sacrifice of the Eucharist. That was his participation in the Eucharist.
Wow.
And he had prepared for that by going to Mass every week. And really, that's what we're all doing. When we go to Mass, we're preparing ourselves to live like Jesus Christ, to make our lives a sacrifice just like he did. And how do we do that? By giving ourselves away all the time in a perfect gift of love, just as Jesus Christ did and just as these early martyrs did.
Right, and this is such a marvelous discussion for us to be having, because really the point of these conversations we're having is light a fire under y'all to get back into the Mass.
Absolutely.
Well, and to look at it in a way, the fathers are reflecting for those who still have lingering doubts. They're reflecting and mirroring what Paul had said in Corinthians, and besides just what Jesus had said in the Gospels, but what Paul taught in Corinthians.
Absolutely. He gives an account of the Last Supper, and he says that this is the prototype of what we're celebrating today. We find that in chapters 10 and chapter 11 of his first letter to the Corinthians. There are a couple of very interesting books that have come out in the last few years, and one of them is by a Protestant scholar, a seminary professor named John Koenig. It's called The Feast of the World's Redemption. And I always used to point to just a handful of texts whenever people said, where is the Eucharist in the New Testament? And I'd point them to about, you know, a dozen texts throughout the New Testament where it, in my opinion, and in the opinion of Catholics and Orthodox and Anglicans, you know, the New Testament is clearly talking about the Eucharist. Well, this man, John Koenig, wrote a book called The Feast of the World's Redemption, and part of his thesis is that almost the entire New Testament is about the Eucharist in one sense or another.
Mm.
It was all intended to be read during worship, and it all assumes the worshiping community and the circumstances of Christian worship. So often, throughout the New Testament, especially in the epistles, when they're talking about glory, when they're talking about sacrifice, when they're talking using metaphors like libation or bread and wine, that the apostles were talking about the Eucharist that was being celebrated. See, there are certain books of the New Testament that Catholics have always said are about the liturgy, like the Book of Revelation.
Right.
Because there are so many details in the Book of Revelation that we recognize from Mass. We find priests in robes and vestments. We find an altar. We find candles. We find the Lamb of God and the Holy, 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 and so many of the prayers that we say in every single Mass.
Right.
But Koenig is doing something even greater than that. He's saying that throughout the New Testament, every book, what we're reading about is the Eucharist. It's an amazing thing.
It gives you a whole new set of lenses to look at as something that we've always known, but maybe never looked at it like that.
Right, right. And it's interesting, you know, as he points out and as other commentators point out, when the New Testament writers describe, for example, the multiplication of loaves and fishes, that they often describe it in terms that everybody recognizes from the liturgy. You know, he looks up to heaven, you know, and blesses the bread and breaks it and distributes it to everybody, and everybody is fed. And these are all things that we recognize, and these are all things that the first Christians would have recognized as Eucharistic images. The same thing with the bread and fish meal by the fire, by the lakeside, after the resurrection in John's Gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the early church, the fish was one of the frequent symbols of the Eucharist. The Protestant scholar Graydon Snyder has written extensively on this, that it's a Eucharistic symbol. And in the earliest pictorial representations of the Last Supper, the ones from the catacombs and from the early mosaics in some of the Italian churches and in Cyprus, we see the apostles and Jesus assembled for the Last Supper, and all we see in the middle of the table is a fish, because the fish represented Jesus Christ symbolically, his real presence.
Oh.
So whenever you're driving down the highway and you see those nice fish bumper stickers,
yep.
That's what you think about. That's Jesus' real presence in the Eucharist. I don't think a lot of people who have those fish bumper stickers understand that.
No.
But in the catacombs and in so much of the archaeological remains of the early church, the fish stands for the Eucharist. If you'll let me ramble on here for
sure, your rambling is like manna. Go right ahead.
There's a wonderful image in one of the catacombs in Rome, and this is a very early image from the church, and it shows two fish, kind of arranged like Pisces, the astrological sign.
Right.
But so there are two fish there, and in the mouth of one fish, there's a loaf of bread. And in the mouth of the other fish, there's a cluster of grapes. So that is the most blatant of all of the signs, the Eucharistic signs that we find in the catacombs that associate the fish with the Eucharist. But it's not the only one. You know, Graydon Snyder said that this is clearly what the early church intended by the fish symbol that was ubiquitous in the church.
Right.
And it's interesting that Scripture would be used to service that liturgy.
Oh, yes. And that from the earliest times, probably before there were the Gospels, it was the Old Testament that was used in the liturgies, because we find that those early Christians were intimately familiar with the Old Testament. But within 100 years, by the time you get to Polycarp, you find someone who's extremely immersed in the New Testament text, and not as familiar with the Old Testament. Clement of Rome, writing maybe in 69 A.D., knew the Old Testament like the back of his hand.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a century later, Polycarp was a little fuzzier. What we find out is about 150 A.D., you know, in that passage I mentioned before where Justin is describing the Mass of the Romans time, you know, he says that they read from the prophets and they read from the memoirs of the apostles. Well, that's what we do today. We read from the Old Testament and we read from the Gospels in every single Mass. The Scriptures have to be read in every Mass today, just as they did then. And at that time, we can appreciate it because most of the people couldn't read. You know, that's probably true that we're dealing with an illiterate population. In any event, they couldn't buy books. Most of them were poor. They couldn't, you know, rustle up enough money to buy books, which were phenomenally expensive, because there were no printing presses.
Right.
Every book had to be copied out by hand, and it took days and weeks of a person's life to copy it out by hand. So you can imagine how much all that time cost, because you're talking about an educated person.
That's right.
So his time was valuable. Most of the people going to Mass could not encounter the Scriptures otherwise than to hear them read, hear them proclaimed in the liturgy, and then hear them expounded, explained, interpreted by the clergy. And this is what happened at least every Sunday, and in some places every day of the week.
Amazing.
Let's talk about the New Testament. I mean, you go back and you give us what we've seen for years, but maybe never really absorbed in our hearts, those images that were given to us in Scripture of the Mass.
Right. You know, the classic text is the accounts of the Last Supper, which we find in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and in St. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. And they all are fairly similar. What we find there is that Jesus took bread and he blessed it and broke it and distributed it. And then he took a cup and he blessed it and he distributed it to his disciples. And St. Paul, and I think St. Luke, too, said that, St. Luke did it, too. But both of them say that he gave a command with it. He said, do this in remembrance of me. And so the early church took that as their cue, that this was what they had to do, something they had to do in remembrance of Jesus, and it was the most important thing they had to do on earth, that this was a thing they had to take from place to place, so that Christ was really present in every land, in every time.
And you connected that for us earlier this hour when you were talking about that remembrance is not just as something you do in your mind. It's putting yourself there.
That's right. Well, we have to remember that when we talk about Jesus and his apostles, we're talking about Jews. And when they, the Jews of that time, when they celebrated the Passover meal, the Seder, they celebrated it not as if they were remembering or recalling a long-ago event, but they celebrated it as if they were participating in that event, as if it were a present reality. You know, the Passover Seder doesn't say that God brought your ancestors out of Egypt. He says, it says God brought you out of Egypt. That's what this is all about. God brought you out of Egypt. And so that remembrance that the Jews celebrated in the Passover was just a foreshadowing of this remembrance that we celebrate in the Mass. This isn't just a psychological act. It's a real presence. It's a remembering. It's a recalling of Jesus Christ. Now, again, not a psychological act. It's a transubstantiation. He's their body, blood, soul, and divinity. And in Luke's account, Jesus says that he's longed to celebrate this Passover with his disciples. Well, we find out that he could hardly wait to celebrate that event again after his resurrection. Because almost immediately upon rising from the dead, what do we find him doing? He's walking along on the road to Emmaus with two of his disciples. Mm-hmm. They don't recognize him. And what does he do? He opens up the scriptures to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they still don't recognize him, but their hearts are pounding, their hearts are burning within them while they hear him opening up the scriptures. And then they get to the place and he blesses bread, and he breaks it, and he gives it to them, right?
Right.
And what happens?
Like,
they know him in the breaking of the bread, and he vanishes. But he didn't really vanish, because he was really present there. That this opening of the scriptures has to lead to Eucharistic communion. It has to, the liturgy of the word has to lead to the liturgy of the Eucharist. And that's why when we get to the Acts of the Apostles, we find that those four things that were the marks of the church at that time, you know, we were talking about that before, the communion, the teaching of the apostles, the breaking of the bread, and the prayers, those four things were the event of the Eucharist, and that was the mark of the church. To be a Christian was to go to Mass, and to go to Mass was to be a Christian. Anyway, this goes on and on and on, as you know from reading my book. We find it in the Epistle to the Hebrews, which is an intensely Eucharistic document. Mm-hmm. We find it in the Book of Revelation, which again shows the union of the Mass on earth with the altar of heaven. And that became something that was such a powerful experience for the early church. As a matter of fact, they would call their altar a table, and they would refer to the heavenly altar being present there at the Mass,
right?
Because it was heaven's altar where the sacrifice was taking place. It's there all through the New Testament. As I said, so many of these modern scholars, and again, not all of them are Catholic, are recognizing this. They're finding that all the New Testament is an intensely Eucharistic book that was produced by an intensely Eucharistic church, and that church was founded by Jesus Christ to be intensely Eucharistic, and he made it plain when he took that bread and blessed it and broke it and distributed it, and he said, do this in remembrance of me.
And for those listeners, and we know you're there because you email us and you correspond with us, we know that those of you who are not Catholic that are struggling with this, the thing that Mike's teaching us right now, it really, when you look at the New Testament through the breaking of the bread, it changes everything.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
It really does. And you point out, too, in that great theology of John chapter 6.
Oh, yes, yes.
I mean, I don't know how you can read that, and you don't want to walk away. You don't want to be one of those that turn around and leave because it's too much to comprehend.
That's right, especially when you consider all of the other bread events in John. You know, right before that, we have his multiplication of the loaves and fishes, again, which the early church saw as a Eucharistic sign. And there he's taking bread and blessing it and breaking it and distributing it. And then at the end of the gospel, when he has that meal by the lakeside with his apostles, there's no more beautiful moment of friendship and fellowship than that moment.
Right.
And that's what we experience in the Eucharist. St. John, Oscar Kuhlmann, a Protestant scholar, called John's gospel the sacramental gospel because it's so intensely Eucharistic. Mm-hmm. It's hard to miss that, but I guess so many people do. So many people do. We have to help them to see it. That changing of the water into wine, that's a prefigurement of transubstantiation. Mm-hmm. There's a change in substance there, and Jesus is doing it on the seventh day. It's a beautiful thing.
Yep.
All through John's gospel, we find these Eucharistic figures. If we're reading the Bible the way the first Christians did, the early Christians, the fathers of the church.
Yeah, reading it and living it.
Well, it's not the same as having Christ walk with us on the road to Emmaus, but when you're there, you really help, Mike. I mean, you are just fantastic.
Well, the fathers help, and I'm reading the fathers aloud these days. So
you do them proud. You do them. You pay them great homage by what you are able to teach us.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
You bet.
It's a great honor.
Mike Aquilina, Mass of the Early Christians. That's going to wrap up our first of several segments that we are going to be doing here to break open the Mass of the Early Christians. Really, just to break open the Mass, bring it on home to everyone. Thank you, Mike, so much for this hour. We appreciate it, and we look forward to our next.
I'm looking forward to it, too.